Republicans to wake up. The Republican Party right now is not led by conservatives. There's a population out there that has to be told the truth. We have to. Do it live!
Now, from the left coast, it's another podcast edition of the Peter B. Collins Show. Peter B. is curious, opinionated, and relentless in pursuit of the truth like a honeybee drawn to pollen. He's an independent progressive, ready to sting Republicans and Democrats alike when they deserve it. After years in commercial radio, Peter B. welcomes you to this audio adventure in news and politics with no corporate filter. Listeners support this program, and you can help at peterbcollins.com. Here's your humble host, Peter B.
Today's program is underwritten by two great Americans from the Pacific Northwest, Bob Vesley of Seattle and Deborah Wiener of Edmonds, Washington. Thank you for your support of the Peter B. Collins Show. If you'd like to help, just go to my website at peterbcollins.com. And you can support our work for as little as $5 a month. Everything is appreciated. This is a very special edition of the Peter B. Collins Show, an exclusive conversation with Sibel Edmonds. Now, many of you know that Sibel and I collaborate, or in some circles they might call it co-conspire, around a podcast series of interviews called The Boiling Frogs. Today, we're going to talk to Sibel Edmonds ungagged, and I have been talking with her on and off since 2004, when I was hosting a radio program called All American Talk Radio on Sirius Satellite Radio. And we've met several times in the intervening years, and I've had the opportunity to talk with her, but our conversations have always been circumscribed because of the bizarre and unprecedented gag orders that have been placed on her. And she now has freed herself from those restrictions. And if you want to dig into this story, I recommend that you go to the website of the American Conservative Magazine. That's amconmag.com. And Philip Giraldi has written a powerful piece coupled with a very interesting interview with Sibel Edmonds. And we're going to be talking about many of those issues in our conversation today. Sibel, thank you very much for talking with us, and I appreciate this exclusive interview.
Well, this is great. Thank you for having me. Your show. It's great to be a guest again.
Well, I want to start with a baseline because you and I have talked many times over the years, but I want to make this accessible to people who may be learning about you and the very important information that you have for the first time. You are by heritage Azerbaijani. You were born in Turkey. You grew up in Iran, and then you emigrated to the United States. And when was that?
Okay, it's a little bit different than that. I am by heritage Turkish.
I'm sorry.
I was born in Iran, but I was given Turkish birth certificate because of my parents being Turkish citizens.
I see.
And I spent several years in Iran, and then I was back in Turkey, and then I went back again to Iran for three more years. Then I was back, and then from Turkey, after graduating from high school, I came to the United States in 1988.
Okay, okay. And where did I get the idea of the Azerbaijani heritage? Is that just an error on my part?
No, it's not, actually. My father is half Azerbaijani,
okay,
half Iranian. But he grew up in Turkey, so he's always been a Turkish citizen.
Okay. And are both your parents still alive?
No, my father passed away in 2000, but my mother is alive.
Okay. And we might talk about that a little later because it's been very difficult for you to see your mother since these problems developed. Now, Sibel Edmonds is founder and president of the National Security Whistleblowers Coalition. She also has a great website where I invite you to stop by and get more information. It is 123realchange.blogspot.com. And that information is in the show files on my website. But again, 123realchange.blogspot.com. And just for a little background information, Sibel worked back in the 1990s. In St. Petersburg, Russia, for the Rostropovich Foundation. She also was a co-founder and executive director of Edmonds Industries, and she has worked as a volunteer in the court program as an advocate for abused children in Alexandria, Virginia. She has an MA in public policy and international commerce from George Mason University, a bachelor's degree in criminal justice and psychology from George Washington University. And we touched on this, but just to restate, she is fluent in Turkish, Farsi, and Azerbaijani. And, Sibel, is there any other part of your background that you'd like to tell us about? One thing I just want to get on the record, have you ever had any contact or any relationship with the intelligence agency of any government besides the United States?
No.
Okay. And is there anything else before we dive in here that you want to tell us, just so people understand who you are and where you're coming from?
No, I think this is a great start, great beginning. And I think as we go through our interview, I will fill in anything that I see, fit with what you're bringing up.
Okay, great. And then one other thing, just so that our listeners understand, you worked as a translator, a language specialist at the FBI. You were hired shortly after the 9/11 events. And what I just want to clarify for people is, as we discuss these issues, particularly of Turkish penetration of American government, both the Congress and the State Department, I'd like you to identify for us, where you can, information that you learned of when you worked at the FBI and information that you may have learned of that's covered by confidentiality agreements, but that is now available for conversation because other people have reported it. So if you can help us with that sourcing, I think that will be useful to people as they try to digest what is a lot of information here that we're going to cover.
Right. And it's very difficult to explain this, but as you ask questions, then on each specific issue, I can tell you about information that is available publicly versus information that I got directly from the FBI through the FBI, mm-hmm. and also historical information background that maybe many people here in the United States don't know about, but they are relevant. They've always been relevant, but they've been blacked out by the mainstream media here because of the relationship with Turkey, the NATO ally in the past, because of the Cold War, and since the end of Cold War, for various reasons, other reasons.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So the events of 9/11 led to a scramble at the Federal Bureau of Investigation, and in particular, they recognized a real deficiency in language specialists related to those who were presumed as suspects in attacking our country. So tell us a little bit about the process, because I understand that you applied for an internship at the FBI several years before, and it was that application that they pulled out after 9/11 that produced a contact and then an interview.
Absolutely, that's accurate. While I was getting my degrees, bachelor's degrees in psychology, it was criminal psychology and criminal justice, I applied for internship position, and in my application, I had to list other qualifications, which included my, languages that I speak. And after 9/11, I was contacted, and I was asked to go there and help them because they were desperate. And at the time, I was getting ready for my master's degree. I had a full-time job, and I took the offer. I accepted the offer and started working for them as a contact linguist, only to help out on this issue of basically going after the terrorists to make the country, my country, our people safe.
Mm-hmm. And so, briefly, what was the process? Did you think that the interview was ordinary and appropriate? Was there anything unusual that tipped you off that you were entering a hornet's nest?
It's interesting because I was never interviewed. In fact, none of the language specialists were ever interviewed. You take a polygraph test before you're granted your top secret clearance for the language division. And also, they do a background check. Now, I don't know how thorough they do it. They perform it. They are supposed to perform it very, very diligently. In my case, I think they did because they even contacted my ex-boyfriend from, 14 years ago. And they actually knocked on their doors, And they did it. Actually, they've done this twice before. before they hired me and after they fired me to find some dirt on me. That's another interesting issue. But so they do the background check, you know, with your, they go and talk to your professors, your previous employers, et cetera, even your neighbors. And also you take the polygraph about, you know, your relationship to any foreign governments, et cetera, or criminal background, and they do criminal background check. But they didn't have any interview process. Nobody actually sits and interviews you to see who you are, what do you think on certain issues, you know.
But somebody had to say, you qualified, we want you to start on Monday, and this is what we'll pay you. So who gave you the indication that you were hired and that you were to report for duty?
Oh, it's hard to tell because it's all done through the headquarters, FBI headquarters in Washington, D.C., through these administrative bureaucrats who sit in the headquarters, and they have a division called the Hiring Employment Division for the language specialists. So I guess the person there who looks at the application made a decision, and she called me and then asked me to basically work for the FBI, which at the time I said, no, I can't. And then she went through the whole spiel of why I should. Then her boss, who was another gentleman, a higher-level gentleman, the FBI's headquarters, he called, and he did a pretty good job of convincing me. And then after him, the supervisor from the Washington, D.C. field office, it's a different building, for that language division, he called me and basically asked me when I could start. And I said, you know, okay, when do you want me to start? And he said, tomorrow. I said, well, tomorrow is Saturday. He said, yeah, that's fine. You can be here on Saturday. So that's how it started.
Well, okay, so you go to the FBI, you pass this background check. And what do they put you to work doing? What did they ask you to do? And how did they brief you or bring you up to speed on some of the materials that you were about to review and translate?
Oh, that's another very complicated process to explain because, at least with my position, because I was doing translations for three languages, I was juggling several balls there, okay, and I was doing several, I was working on several different operations and several different divisions. On emergency, urgent cases, I work counterterrorism. And that means, and this is throughout the country, not only the FBI's Washington field office. I would, let's say, go to work, and the supervisors would say, okay, here are the files that just came from Chicago. Or it came from Paterson, New Jersey, that has to do with 9/11 terrorism.
Mm-hmm.
Here's an agent's name, and this is the file. They want you to immediately look at this. And even though there is no time to do verbatim translation takes a long time. You have to do word-by-word translation.
Sure.
They need a summary translation to see how sensitive is the information and whether or not they want to have a verbatim translation of this. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
So that was so unpredictable. I worked for, you know, at least with 15, 20 different divisions and agents across the country, including Los Angeles. And some of them were documents, some of them were tapes, you know, some of them just, you know, I can't talk about some of the details, but that had to do with counterterrorism. And I didn't have a assigned really boss or anything, supervisor for that. It was whoever had a very urgent request of translation, whether in Farsi or Turkish or Azerbaijani, across the country.
Mm-hmm. And was there a clear agenda, or did you just show up in the morning and have a bunch of stuff thrown at you and then be told, put that on hold because this just came in and this is a higher priority?
Well, no, I was going to get to that because that was the unpredictable day-to-day things that came up. But my primary job had to do with the Turkish counterintelligence at the FBI's Washington field office, and that was, and until I left, was the only field office for the FBI with translation services for Turkish counterintelligence. Now, for that, I had a specific agent that I reported to who was in the same building, one floor up from me, and his name was is Dennis Sasher, a great special agent. So he was in charge of counterintelligence operations related to Turkish operatives and operations. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
And that was my permanent That was my main task. So unless some urgent things came from different field offices, in some cases I had to just hop in the car and go to Philadelphia to translate for some suspects they had arrested, because the suspects didn't speak any English. You know, they may have been Iranians or they may have been Turkish, and then here there are FBI agents, they want to question them. You know, how did you get to the country? Who are you? You know, et cetera. So I would go and I would translate. I would translate the questions and I would translate the answers. So those were unpredictable. But my main task, my main job was Turkish counterintelligence. And I was the only person there doing the Turkish counterintelligence translations for specific operations related to Turkey. And again, those operations varied. It could have been, you know, written translations on documents, or it could have been audio. And later, about 2 months after I started, I was contacted by FBI's Chicago field office. First, the agent in charge of the Turkish counterintelligence in Chicago field office had conversations with my agent in Washington, D.C. So the agent in Chicago is Joel Roberts, Special Agent Joel Roberts, who had been in charge of Turkish counterintelligence. So he had discussions with my agent in Washington, D.C., my permanent agent that I reported to. And because their investigations and operations overlapped, and because the Chicago field office were not happy with the quality of the translations they had from, I'm talking about 1996 till 2001, and because their operation was about to be shut down in Chicago by the Justice Department, unless they produced even more explosive evidence and causes to convince DOJ not to shut it down, to basically raise hell, for those reasons, the Chicago field office agent, Agent Roberts, decided to contact me, my division, my agent, my supervisor, and say, I really need her services. I need her to work with me. So I'm going to be sending thousands of communication collected from 1996 till right now. And some of them have been marked as extremely important. You know, they call it pertinent. And I wanted to focus on that as she's working for Dennis Thatcher for DC operations. And as she will see, these operations overlap. So my main job was Turkish counterintelligence operations for Washington, D.C., for Dennis Thatcher, and for Chicago field office operations from Turkish counterintelligence for Agent Joel Roberts.
Okay. And you just told us that some of these materials went back five, six, even 7 years from the time period when we were focused on the events of 9/11. Does that suggest that that material had not been examined or translated, and that there's just this huge pile of stuff that, that was unaddressed and that could have contained information had it been reviewed before 9/11 that could have changed the course of history?
Well, there were some cases where the they were all supposedly looked at, but not with good quality, meaning the translators they had were not qualified translators. And therefore, and because they were declared not qualified to perform verbatim translation, all they had done, for example, they would listen to a call or a communication conversation between two individuals that took, let's say, 10 minutes, and they would have a 10-minute conversation, ongoing conversation, would take about three, 4 pages of transcript, okay, if you do verbatim, but they would have maybe 4 lines saying, okay, it's important, they were talking about, let's say, stealing some material from this department by going through this person, instead of verbatim of what was it exactly, how they were going to do it. So if those were submitted that way, and this was the reason for this agent in Chicago for these files, and also with Dennis Thatcher asking me to spend most of my time going over those that were stamped as pertinent and get more details so they would build their case for DOJ, because DOJ kept shutting down this operations, various field offices in the U.S. Now they were going after Chicago to shut it down because it touched upon certain diplomatic relations. They were looking for more ammunition to fight the DOJ, making a case saying there is no way you should shut down this operation. Like Sabal, these are that have been already marked as pertinent. Their summary, we wanted to one by one go through those, the pertinent ones, and dig up more and give us more detail. So that was what I was doing for the FBI most of the time. And in addition to that, some counterterrorism operations.
Mm-hmm. Now, Sabal, in the allegations that have surfaced, some in the past and now in greater detail in the American Conservative article by Phil Giraldi, who, by the way, is a conservative himself and a former CIA officer, we could break it down into a couple of areas. One was that there were sloppy operations and there was an effort at the FBI and the Translation Department to build up a backlog in order to get Congress to give them a larger budget. That actually occurred in the following year, and the Inspector General has validated that issue. There also were improper actions by fellow translators, and then there is material that you were assigned that showed you of criminal activity, demonstrated to you that there's criminal activity being monitored by the FBI related to members of Congress and to top State Department officials. So if you would, in the chronology, starting in September up through March, when you blew the whistle and ultimately were dismissed, what were the first red flags that surfaced?
Yeah, to go through that, it would take a long, long time. And there's been so many documented information and articles I have written. And also, if you go to DOJ IG, Inspector General's report, you will see that, because the problems were divided into two categories, okay, the problems that I reported, okay?
Mm-hmm.
One category were administrative problems, okay?
Right.
And these were hiring of translators who were not qualified, you know, and the backlog that you just mentioned, intentionally building up backlogs, et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
The second set had to do with the operations that had criminal elements in them.
Right.
And those were being basically shut down by the Justice Department instead of, as once upon a time they were doing, pursuing them criminally, they were shutting them down. Now, to clarify this, when I went, I went through the whole, you know, chain of command thing within the FBI, the Justice Department, and I went to Congress. But when I went to the IG, Inspector General's office, in fact, I was accompanied by staff from Senator Leahy and Senator Grassley's office. They asked the IG, Glenn Fine's office, personally, to expeditiously investigate my case and produce report in a very short frame of time, because they were going to have hearings in the Senate, and they were carrying out their own investigations. This is the Senate, but they wanted their report too. And they got promise. And this was both in writing and verbally from the IG office, that when I went to them, it was around May, that the report would be issued by September that year, in 3-4 months. Okay, Peter?
Mm-hmm.
So it's interesting. And when I went to IG, all my interviews there were at the presence of my attorneys. I went there with my attorneys, and I spent hours, several sessions with them. But I told them, I said, the most important part is the criminal part, and that has to do with the espionage-related activity. And these criminal corruption-related activities. And at that point, the Inspector General's office, they said, that's not what the Inspector General's office does. They only investigate the administrative stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So the process we were promised on the record, and my attorneys are taking notes, was you tell us about all the administrative stuff, including this translator Dickerson, who mm-hmm. was... they found out that actually she was working for the targets of FBI's investigations. However, the criminal elements that has to do with the corruption, the U.S. congressional people, people within the State Department, Pentagon, that didn't fall within their jurisdiction. This is Inspector General's office jurisdiction.
Mm-hmm.
And they said, once we complete our report, and this is the IG report, okay, and we submit it to Congress, we also submit it to DOJ with the request for a special prosecutor to take care of the criminal elements of your report,
mm-hmm.
meaning the people in Congress, how things were covered up, et cetera. So that was a promise we were given. That was the promise that my attorneys were given, okay? So they said, all right, you know, even though inside the skiff I gave them the brief overview of these criminal stuff, they said, no, that will be for the special prosecutor, and that would be after we finish and issue our report. So they tried to keep their hands out of it.
Just a quick comment. What you said there in the skiff, that's in a secure hearing room.
Correct. It's a secured, compartmentalized intelligence information facility where nobody can come and bug it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, sound doesn't transmit. You can't take your cell phone. You go in there, and you can talk about classified information,
right?
Highly classified information. You can disclose intelligence gathering methods. You can talk about informants, for example, or certain surveillance. Those things, I couldn't even talk about those with my attorneys. I've never talked about those, really,
mm-hmm.
because those are truly sensitive
mm-hmm.
because they are used in various operations, ongoing operations. So those things and some details, you would discuss it inside the skiff. So everybody would there would have clearance. The IG inspector would have clearance. His or her assistant would have clearance. Same thing with the Senate. Whenever I went to Congress, parts of certain aspects of my meetings would occur in a meeting room with them, but then for certain portion, I would go inside the skiff, which I've done so many times, with staff members who had clearance.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, since Glenn Fine, his office split it up into two categories, why don't we do the same? And let's talk now first about the administrative issues, and in particular, this woman, Melek Khan, C-A-N, Dickerson. And she was married, is married to Douglas Dickerson, who is an Air Force officer and was also a military attaché at the U.S. Embassy in Ankara, Turkey, serving under Mark Grossman in the 1990s. Tell us about Ms. Dickerson and what surfaced in working with her. I think she said she was just a couple of desks down from you. What was she doing that caused concern for you and ultimately you reported to your superiors?
Again, there's so much information in there, and it will take hours to explain the case. As you know, Vanity Fair has written about this. I have given hundreds of interviews on this, and it will take totally hours. And because a lot of them are, it's public information, I'm not going to get into details.
Mm-hmm.
But I will talk to you about the important aspects of it. Yes, Melek Can Dickerson, and in Turkish it's pronounced Melek John Dickerson.
Oh, okay.
She was from Turkey. Her husband is an American, Douglas Dickerson. At the time, he was a major. And she was hired by the FBI and given clearance and about a month and a half after I was hired. But because she didn't pass the English portion of the test, she was considered the monitor, not the translator, meaning she could not do verbatim. She was not allowed to do verbatim translations. She could not do interviews, for example, live translations. Simultaneous translations. So actually, I had to be like in a supervisory position. She had to report to me, and if anything was pertinent, then I would translate it verbatim.
Mm-hmm.
And I had to sign and initial everything she did because monitors can't translate verbatim stuff, etc.
Gotcha.
And so yes. And after she started working there, and again, there is this very long story of she came to my house with her husband for a visit, and a lot of other things that occurred, and these are all documented, and I have repeated it hundreds, not thousands of times. We ended up, and this is my agent and I, we ended up finding out that she previously worked for two organizations that were the targets of FBI's counterintelligence operations investigations, and the names have surfaced since. Before I couldn't name those, one of those organizations she worked for, called the Association or Assembly of Turkish American Associations, ATAA.
Mm-hmm.
It's a semi-lobby, even though they don't declare themselves that, and it's one of those nonprofit organizations that's like AIPAC.
Okay.
The other one was the American Turkish Council
mm-hmm.
that she worked for. And she was also liaison from ATAA to work with the Turkish military attaché in Washington, D.C., which is under Turkish embassy. Well, that made the entire thing, meaning all the people that she worked for up until she took the job with the FBI, happened to be all of them primary targets of FBI investigation. And somehow, something had happened, and she was granted clearance without going through polygraph, without having background check. And we still don't know how that has occurred. The Senate knows. The Senate Judiciary Committee, Senator Grassley and Senator Leahy, they got to find, you know, they found out. That's why they declared the espionage case later. And this was Senator Grassley on the record,
mm-hmm.
that this was a classic espionage case. But I still don't know how she ended up being hired, getting hired by the FBI.
Mm-hmm.
And not only that, so this was her past employment up until she, like even her basic tax records, because you have to submit all those for your background investigation, would have shown that she was getting paid by the targets of FBI's investigation. And her husband, and that's another interesting element, he had worked from 1992, that may be end of 1992, maybe mid-1992, until about 1996, 1997, for the U.S. military attaché in Ankara,
mm-hmm.
in under U.S. embassy. And he reported directly to the ambassador, and back then he was under ambassador, he was the assistant, then he became ambassador to Mark Grossman.
Mm-hmm.
Mark Grossman was his direct boss,
mm-hmm.
boss in Turkey. And again, Mark Grossman was a person of interest.
Right, and we'll detail the
correct.
Situation about him in a little bit.
And then he had come back to the United States, and at the time when they came to my house, Douglas Dickerson was working for the office of Douglas Feith, and he was the liaison intelligence officer, and because his background was Air Force, but DIA, also Defense Intelligence Agency,
mm-hmm.
and he was liaison between the office of Douglas Feith and the State Department on the issues related to Turkey, Turkmenistan, Uzbekistan, all the Turkic-speaking nations, as those related to those nations' weapon procurement from us. And I'm talking about legal weapons procurement,
mm-hmm.
at least the description of his job, meaning then Turkey buys $4 billion, et cetera, et cetera.
Sure.
He would be involved in those. Okay.
Okay. Uh-huh.
And in addition to that, he was actively working while he's an Air Force officer, while he's working for Douglas Feith and with the State Department. He was actively working with the American-Turkish Council, and he was a member of American-Turkish Council. Like, they're not the board members, but they have this list of people who perform different things for them,
mm-hmm.
which happened to be, again, working for an organization that was a target.
Very interesting. Now, briefly, when they came to visit you unexpected at your home, what proposition did they make to you?
Basically, the proposition was I would have a lot of advantages. And again, I have done this so many times, and it's out there, and it will take hours, because everybody considers this really old story because it's been reported billions of times, Peter.
Mm-hmm.
But that they would provide these advantages and those advantages if I were to go with them and start working with the American-Turkish Council. And in fact, because if I were to do that, I would retire early, and have, because they would have parts of my payments would happen in Turkey. At a time, I already had some business dealings with Turkey, but that they would set me there so I could just, my husband and I could retire, move there, have a very lavish life,
mm-hmm.
and that. So basically, they asked me to go and work for the target organization.
Yeah, so they wanted to, and it suggests that they are double agents.
Well, that's the thing. One of the things that the Senate Judiciary Committee looked at was whether or not they were double agents. And what they declared after, this is the Senate Judiciary Committee, interviewing all the relevant people from the FBI and the background stuff on Douglas Dickerson that even I don't have, and her, they said basically they were spies for the Turkish operatives here in the United States.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So one of the other administrative issues related to the hiring of a woman named Hadaya Roberts, also in the language section of the FBI. Tell us about her situation and why it raised eyebrows.
Well, at the time, I really didn't know much about this. I found out more about this stuff after I left the FBI, because Hadaya seemed like a very nice lady, you know, in her mid-40s, late-40s, and she was working, again, a few desks from me. And she was performing translations for Urdu and Pashto. She spoke two different dialects of. And she dealt with the Pakistan counterintelligence. And interestingly, she was open about her background. She actually talked about the fact that her father was a very important person, or was a very important person. I don't remember if he is or was, and then worked, and he was a general. And later, after I left the FBI, I found out more, the fact that as we are going to publish John Cole's interview, he was in charge of his counterespionage investigations and also the background check on translators. Not only that, her father, Hadiah Roberts' father, was a general, retired general. He actually worked in the D.C. military attaché for Pakistan. And he was identified because all those people who work in the military attaché, okay, they happen to be the ISI. And that's like a classic case. It's not only for Pakistan.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, I would say, 90% of the people working for Turkish military attaché, they are basically MIT.
MIT is the Turkish Intelligence Service, and ISI is the Pakistani equivalent of our CIA.
Correct. So mm-hmm. they are considered the persons of interest. So there are eyes watching these to make sure that we know if they are involved, which they are going to be involved, of course, in espionage activities to steal information, intelligence from, you know, various government agencies or, you know, similar activities. So her father was that. Basically, her father was ISI general in military attaché, within the military attaché in D.C. for Pakistan, and that institution happens to be the main target of the FBI's Pakistan counterintelligence division, where she translated, meaning she was a translator who listened to the communication of these people who were her father's previous friends, you know, colleagues. In fact, the direct boss for her father in late 1990s, or I believe like 1999, 1998, happened to be this famous general whose name kept, you know, surfacing after 9/11 was General Mahmoud. General mm-hmm. Mahmoud was a direct boss for Hadiah Roberts' father.
Mm-hmm.
The fact that she was hired, despite this fact, even though it had raised, you know, flag, and she was actually performing translation. Now, did she mistranslate things? I have no idea because I was not involved with that division.
Mm-hmm.
John Cole would know more about that.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Anything else in the administrative area before we move on to the criminal activity?
Oh, there were tons of stuff which basically you would find in almost, I believe, after especially setting up my organization and dealing with so many whistleblowers, that you would find in every single government agency, which would be waste, fraud, and abuse.
Mm-hmm.
And those cases, you get unlimited amount of those. And so, again, it's a classic government agency bureaucracy engaged in waste, fraud, and abuse. And again, as I said, those were not the reasons. Those were not the issues that I blew the whistle on. However, with the Inspector General's office, they said because of their jurisdiction, that had to go to a special prosecution division with the DOJ and be pursued criminally.
Now, Sibel, let me pull a quote here from Philip Giraldi's article called Found in Translation that is in the current issue of the American Conservative, as background here for the next phase of our conversation. The American-Turkish Council, founded in 1994 and modeled on the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee, or AIPAC, was intended to promote Turkish interests in Congress and in other public forums. Edmonds refers to ATC and AIPAC as sister organizations. The group, referring to includes, the founders include a number of prominent Americans involved in the Israel-Turkey relationship, notably Henry Kissinger, Brent Scowcroft, Richard Perle, Douglas Feith, and former Congressman Stephen Solars. Perle and Feith had earlier been registered lobbyists for Turkey through Feith's company, International Advisors Incorporated. The FBI was interested in ATC, the American-Turkish Council, because it suspected that the group derived at least some of its income from drug trafficking, Turkey being the source of 90% of the heroin that reaches Europe, and because of reports that it had given congressmen illegal contributions or bribes. Moreover, as Edmonds told the Times of London, the Turks have often, quote, acted as a conduit for the Inter-Services Intelligence, Pakistan's spy agency, because they were less likely to attract attention. So did you know about the American-Turkish Council at all before you went to work for the FBI?
Yeah, and I thought they were, you know, legitimate, kind of a lobby organization that promoted business between United States and Turkish. I'm talking about commerce, like promoting commerce.
Mm-hmm.
So I'd heard of them, and that's all I knew when it came to the American-Turkish Council.
Okay. And so tell us what you learned over the course of working at the FBI about ATC.
Well, again, I am not getting into some classified information that are legitimately maybe classified, and maybe we'll be more specific. There are certain operatives within the American-Turkish Council who are engaged in espionage activities, in false end user certificate, meaning when there are things exported here from certain companies to certain countries, those countries actually are not the actual recipients of those shipments.
Mm-hmm.
So the shipments actually is diverted from Turkey to other countries, the countries that we have, you know, we don't have commerce relationship with or we have sanctions on. So there were various illegal activities and, as I said, espionage related, corrupting congressional people, and drug related.
Mm-hmm.
Right. See, again, this will be one interview by itself, because in order to explain this, you would need at least half an hour, 45 minutes, because American-Turkish Council is not what, you know, this thing happens exactly. Just like AIPAC, okay? AIPAC is one organization that is known as one organization. But if you go and see all these other sub-organizations and chapters all across the country, you know, they're called, like, I don't know, American Jewish Council.
Mm-hmm.
Benai. Oh, so you just name them. A lot of these little mini Israeli organizations actually work with AIPAC, and a lot of activities for AIPAC is carried out through these organizations.
Mm-hmm.
They don't get their hands dirty from the top there. And because ATC was modeled after AIPAC, and the reason it was modeled after AIPAC was, as you mentioned, in 1989, Richard Perle and Douglas Feig, they set up this company, International Advisors, Inc., and they registered themselves under FARA as foreign agents for the government of Turkey. And they were receiving, you know, $500,000, $1 million or more per year, two of them, representing the Turkish government's interests. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
Then there was a scandal because Perle was at the time, in early 1990s, around 92 or 93, I'm not sure, was working for Pentagon. So Wall Street Journal had this article that exposed this conflict of interest. I know, ironically, Wall Street Journal going after Perle, ironically again, saying that, hey, wait a second, he's a foreign agent. He's a registered foreign agent.
Mm-hmm.
Yet he has access to all the sensitive information in Pentagon and as an advisor works for Pentagon. Something is really wrong here.
Mm-hmm.
Well, they freaked out. This is Perle and Feig in 1993. So they shut down. Even though it was very lucrative, it was very successful, they shut it down. And as you know, as everyone who, or most people who listen to your show, to our show, they know, Perle and Feig have always been known as the agent for Israel, too. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
So they shut down International Advisors, Inc., and they're like, okay, this got too visible, it kind of raised too much stink, too much smell, let's do it AIPAC way. Okay? Meaning set up this organization and sub-organizations and chapters so we won't raise the red flag. We don't even have to be shown as a registered agents for Turkey.
Mm-hmm.
So those people, Perle and Feig, together with Kissinger, at the time Brenda Scowcroft was not in this, Kissinger, they helped, together with the top people from the AIPAC boards and management, they actually created the miniature AIPAC. Everything modeled. Their accounting system is totally modeled after AIPAC. Okay? In fact, they even have some companies they hire for accounting in order to, you know, circumvent certain stuff that they use the same companies as AIPAC for their accounting services. Again, this is public stuff. People can go and find out.
Mm-hmm.
Any investigative journalist can go and find out. They use the same legal advisors in many cases, ATC. So they modeled this little mini AIPAC called American Turkish Council, Kissinger, Perle, and Feig. And then they started doing the same model as AIPAC, this little mini ATCs that popped up everywhere more and more. And And if right now you look, and especially when we get to the case for David Krikorian that is being exposed, hundreds of these little mini organizations, Turkish organizations promoting Turkish interests, et cetera, Turkish culture, started popping up all over the country. You know? In some states, maybe 6, 7, 8, in some states, 1. And under different names, all under non-profit, all under some fake, you're promoting Turkish folklore. I mean, you would think, how many Turks do we have in this country? I don't know, about 300,000, 400,000? Then you look at it and you're like, you know, there are hundreds of these organizations. Well, they actually all function, if not all, most, under ATC umbrella, even though structurally they are not connected. They won't look as connected, but you will see the same players. Same with AIPAC, ATC also is not registered under lobbying firm. That means this gives them a lot of freedom to go and do a lot of lobbying activities and yet not do it transparently, because they are not, because just like AIPAC, they are not registered as lobby firm for Turkey. It's the same model. You're looking at the same and the same player. And I don't know about the functions. I'm not familiar with any kind of operations done through AIPAC, except the ones that we all know that have publicly been available, but carry out a lot of criminal activities against the United States national security, against their business interests. And when I say that, it doesn't mean automatically this is going to be for Turkish interests. It's not for the people's interests, neither in Turkey nor in the United States. It may end up, it does benefit greatly, tremendously, the special interest, what I call the invisible government in both countries, and that is the military-industrial complex here, the oil companies here, and in Turkey is the certain Turkish military-related individual, an officer. But that's the advantage. That's not to say, okay, it's against U.S. people's interest because they are representing the Turkish people's interest. No, nobody's representing Turkish people's interests either.
Here's another quote from the Giraldi piece in the American Conservative. Edmonds claims that Mark Grossman, ambassador to Turkey from 94 to 97 and undersecretary of state for political affairs from 2001 to 2005, was a person of interest to the FBI and had his phone tapped by the Bureau in 01 and 02. In the third highest position at the State Department, Grossman wielded considerable power personally and within the Washington bureaucracy. He had access to classified information of the highest sensitivity from the CIA, NSA, and Pentagon, in addition to his own State Department. On one occasion, Grossman was reportedly recorded making arrangements to pick up a cash bribe of $14,000 or $15,000 from an ATC contact. The FBI also intercepted related phone conversations between the Turkish embassy and the Pakistani embassy that revealed sensitive U.S. government information was being sold to the highest bidder. Grossman, who emphatically denies Edmonds' charges, is currently vice chairman of the Cohen Group, founded by Clinton Defense Secretary William Cohen, where he reportedly earns a seven-figure salary, much of it coming from representing Turkey. So what can you tell us about the information that surfaced in your job about Mark Grossman, and in particular, what happened when your superiors became aware of that?
Well, I have to make a lot of corrections. Number one, I confirmed it after this information became public from other sources.
Okay.
Mark Grossman's name, I did not use Mark Grossman's name. I did not divulge it. It became public, and I confirmed it. Number two, the fact that his numbers were tapped, that's absolutely inaccurate. And I'm not going to get into the intelligence gathering methods. But you have primary targets, you have secondary targets, you have, you know, it goes down. Meaning, if you have, under FISA, a foreign agent tapped, okay, then the U.S. persons who may be calling that foreign agent who's tapped, or when that foreign agent calls that U.S. person,
understood,
that information goes there. So information, a lot of information gets obtained from that part. Okay?
All right.
Now, once you come across criminal activities and collect enough evidence to show that that U.S. person is engaged in criminal activities, espionage activities, now this is the standard, this is the kosher side of the procedure. Is it done always that way? Sometimes not, and I will get to that. Then the agents. They reported to the Justice Department's attorneys. The Justice Department attorneys take that evidence collected from FISA, okay, on the foreign agents to the court, show the special FISA judge, say, look, you know, we have to get permission and we have to get the special warrant to go after this U.S. person because we have evidence that this U.S. person is engaged in high-level criminal activities or espionage activities. Then they get warrant, legal warrant, if they're doing it legally, to go, let's say in this case, after Grossman and tap his life. And if or when they do that, Peter, that is not under FISA. That won't be under, let's say, Turkish counterintelligence division where I work.
Mm-hmm.
At that time, when they go and tap Grossman directly, that information goes directly to the FBI agents and analysts. It bypasses a translator.
Sure, I understand that.
Okay, so I wouldn't even know what it would go there.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the reason I said if they are doing it kosherly is my organization, NSWBC, released this signed and sealed and stamped document. It had to do with Agent Gilbert Graham, the special agent in FBI who retired in 2002, and he filed this report with the DOJ, Department of Justice's Inspector General's office. Now, Gilbert Graham worked in Washington, D.C. field office, where I worked, and he was an agent involved in charge of a particular division that dealt with Turkish counterintelligence and also in general counterespionage, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And at the time when he filed this, I didn't even know him personally. He filed this even before I went there to Congress, et cetera, okay, with the IG. Basically, the redacted version is available saying that the FBI actually illegally, meaning circumventing that procedure that I explained to you, got hot-headed, basically, and they went and directly tapped certain U.S. congressional people and, in some cases, certain executive-appointed people.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? So, meaning they didn't go and get the warrant. And I know why they did that, the agency. I know there should be no excuse for it, but I also know that they were so desperate because they had so much evidence built up from my division on these people, okay?
Well, and one of the situations is, as we just alluded to in the quote from the Giraldi article, is that Mark Grossman was in a position where he would be notified of investigations of any persons of interest at, for example, the State Department.
Not the State Department, but the people that he actually himself was working for. If, for example, how do I explain this without going through classification? Let's say, hypothetically, okay, let's say the FBI's Pakistani counterintelligence division find out that the second guy from the top in the military attaché is actually ISI spy who's actively spying. His job is spying, his official assignment, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Then the FBI has to notify the State Department, and that will be including the division where Mark Grossman is,
mm-hmm.
okay? Especially if he's involved with Pakistan in the State Department,
mm-hmm.
and say, by the way, oh, you're going to have diplomatic incident here. Why? Well, we just identified, you know, XYZ, who is the whatever major, Pakistani major in the military attaché, we have now proof that he's actually a spy, and his official task is to gather information, okay? Then, let's say if Mark Grossman is in charge of Pakistan in the State Department, Mark Grossman diplomatically will call the head of the military attaché for ISI, say, you know what, we found out about your guy, because you're an ally country. Tell him to get the hell out of U.S., okay, because we don't want to be in the position of. And then the military attaché says, okay, thank you. So they send that guy back to Pakistan. And in a few months or in a few days, they will have somebody else covered
mm-hmm.
that division. And then FBI eventually finds out who that particular person is through listening, et cetera. Then they notify the State Department. So that's what a person in the position of Mark Grossman would be notified about, but not if the U.S. person under investigation is in the State Department, not necessarily. But the foreign person, yes.
Now, Sibel, one of the things that you have informed us of that I find fascinating is that Mark Grossman, allegedly blew the cover on Brewster Jennings. Brewster Jennings was the CIA front company that became better known when Valerie Plame Wilson's identity was released, and that case ultimately resulted in the conviction of Scooter Libby. Tell us a little bit about what occurred there and what Grossman allegedly did.
Well, again, I did not put this information out. Times UK obtained an anonymous letter, okay, which they later verified and found the source, I believe. It was sent them anonymously with supporting documents that pointed directly to Mark Grossman as the person. And up until that point, I had just, general terms, I've been telling people this case is not accurate because Brewster Jennings got dismantled in summer 2001 without getting into detail of what happened. But because they brought that information to me, I confirmed that that was the case, and I confirmed that, yes, the person who had this communication was Mark Grossman.
And Do we have any idea of what the implications of that were? And then was Brewster Jennings some sort of a cutout that surfaced later in the Libby investigation, and it had no real function at that point?
Correct. There was no Brewster Jennings. That's the thing that people don't understand. And if maybe pressured, CIA will confirm it. I know the documents they got confirmed. There was no Brewster Jennings. This makes that case very complicated. Cover was really blown up as Brewster Jennings as a covert agent. That occurred in August. It had nothing to do with Valerie Plame. Brewster Jennings, this cover CIA organization, was active within ATC, and there were certain Turkish business groups who were actually negotiating, talking with them. They wanted to hire them to act as their not only analysts, but also in some of their, you know, middlemen people with some of their dealings that had to do with obtaining certain information here in the United States, but under some semi-legal umbrella, okay?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And it was State Department's Grossman who informed a certain target individual, Turkish individual, saying, do not even dare going that way, because Brewster Jennings is nothing but a cover, government cover. He didn't even use the word CIA, the government cover.
Mm-hmm.
Which meant they are basically covert operatives,
mm-hmm,
for U.S. government. And that basically tipped off the whole thing. And the FBI, when they got that information, they notified the CIA. And in August 2001, Brewster Jennings was dismantled. No more Brewster Jennings. Brewster Jennings did not exist. In fact, FBI recommended that the CIA would engage in damage assessment, meaning because of that leak, if they had lost anybody. And I have no idea what happened with that, because that was not my area. It was just the agents I worked for were involved with those and the headquarters.
Okay. Sibel, what can you tell us about information that you have, that you've been able to confirm, about the trading of military or nuclear secrets through these networks that could have compromised the security of the United States?
Again, this is published in details, and these operatives, they had their own people, sub-operatives, who obtained information from various facilities, nuclear facilities, whether they were attached to U.S. military, for example, Air Force, or they were just a nuclear lab, and they could obtain information through either what they call the student programs or through influencing people.
We're talking with Sibel Edmonds here on the Peter B. Collins Show. Our program is sponsored by the Organic Wine Company. Now that you're eating organic, it's time to drink organic wine. Try the fine, earth-friendly wines imported by the Organic Wine Company since 1980. Just click on the link, or clink on that link if you like, on my homepage at peterbcollins.com. There's a special introductory offer. It's tasty and it's affordable, so check it out. Sibel, next, I want to move to the set of issues related to penetration of members of Congress. And over the years, you have alluded to these issues, and on a website, you put up a series of pictures without names of your own rogues gallery. Give us a little more information about what you know about the way Turkey and its subgroups and agents have been able to influence members of Congress in very troubling ways.
Correct. As part of my training briefing, before you start doing the counterintelligence translations with the FBI agent that I just named, Dennis Basher, you go through training and also a lot of briefings and meetings, and because they have to do it with the language specialist. And I know many agents don't do that either. There's no time or they're not good at it, but my agent was very, very good at it. And they kind of give you an overview of why they consider certain things pertinent and what it should be that you're looking for, how you look for it, and how you even interpret certain things, okay? For example, they would teach you that if there's this communication between two people and the guy says, well, okay, you make sure you drop the package at 2 o'clock. Regular language specialists without really training in counterintelligence would say, okay, I'm not going to even translate. This is not pertinent. Somebody's going to drop a package. But if you're working counterintelligence, okay, operations, then that can be extremely important piece of information, and it's put together with previous information, okay? For example, maybe 3 weeks before, the counterintelligence intercept has collected this information that said, oh, I will send you that $11,000 in cash, okay, and I will have my guy call you and deliver it to you, right? Let's say you're listening to a foreign target, all right?
Okay.
And if that foreign target is giving this $11,000 to a U.S. person, okay, let's say if that person is an elected official, that's a huge deal, right? But if the language specialist doesn't have that background, and if package deliver, because in the conversation they may not say, I'm going to deliver the package that has $11,000 to you. So that is extremely important, package exchanging hands, okay? And if that information is intercepted in time, okay, then the FBI agents, because it's stamped as pertinent by the language specialist, right? Then the agent has the time, he has the heads up, and will get the surveillance team to go in that location and see that this foreign agent or this foreign agent's assistant is delivering this package that they talked about, let's say, to this representative chief of staff in the through the back door of, let's say, the Dirksen building, right? So that can become a very, very important piece of information. That's why you're briefed about these transactions, who you're dealing with, et cetera. And as part of the briefing, I was told that for a while, the person, the U.S. person of interest in Congress was only one man for a long time for Turkey, who happened to be one of the most important persons after Tom Lantis, was Stephen Solar as a congressman. This is long before I was. But then gradually, these targets, operatives, they and through these organizations, and of course by their guidance from through AIPAC, they learned to play the game, and they have started increasing the numbers of people they influence and how they influence, because there's so many ways you can influence. You don't only donate money to a PAC. That's just one way out of hundreds of ways of giving money to a certain congressional person. And if certain representative is not that materialistic, then there are other ways you can get this person. You can find this person's vulnerability. Does he like women? He's married, he likes women. You know, you can set him up with a woman, and then you can use that information later against him. So there are all these, and these things happen not only with Turkey. These operations take place for almost every important counterintelligence operations in the United States, and that would be to a certain level the Pakistanis may be doing. There are certain levels of Turks are doing a certain level, you know, so it's done. It's classic. In some ways, it's classic. Now, the extent of it, that's what gets the thing to a different level. To what extent? And what is it you're asking that congressional person? Again, it's one thing that foreigner giving money through various channels to this particular representative or representative to, let's say, influence certain foreign policy. That's one level. In some cases, they do it to actually access information because certain congressional representatives, they have high data that they get briefed, whether it's on CIA or DIA or, you know. So, again, so the level of importance increases based on what it is they're doing. What is it they're, what it is that they're getting from this particular person. So the Turkish operatives, they increase their influence and how they did it and the methods, thanks to their mentors.
Mm-hmm.
So it ended up getting to be more than one person. So Stephen Solar resigned, got out of the Congress.
Mm-hmm.
They went and they said, okay, so we did a lot of, gave you a lot of payments while you were there through various channels. And as we promised, you know, we put a lot of things as we agreed upon in IOU column. So now you, we're going to hire as the lobbyist for us, okay?
Mm-hmm.
You help us with getting your replacement there in Congress, okay? Because at the time, Stephen Solar was pretty powerful in Congress.
Yes, he was.
So, yeah, so he gets to be hired by the agents. And I'm saying it's classic because the same model repeated with others, because then they have to pass the torch. Their value when they are hired as a lobbyist, let's say by Turkey or Israel, in this case Turkey, is how many inside, you know, they can get for their clients. The client ends up being Turkey, right? And Stephen Solar is registered agent for Turkey, okay? The lobbyist at this point. He says, okay, I have two of my boys that I have pretty good relationship. They have nice vulnerabilities, and one of them is very hungry for money, you know, for campaign and things. So I'll get you those guys. So you give me $1 million a year, okay? So that's the game that's being played. So they increased by 1998, 1999. They had some hotshots in Congress. And it's interesting, and I don't know why this is, because I have no idea why it is. Maybe it's because the prices are much higher. It's much higher in the Senate. They were all House. These operations didn't deal with the Senate. None. So I don't know who gets the ones in the Senate. Are they the Saudis or is it the mostly Israel? I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
Because supposedly they are not that affordable. They, it's much cheaper and easier to get a congressman in the House. Than
I see.
Okay?
Now, let's
they
talk.
Have none.
Let's talk about Tom Lantos. He died about a year and a half ago. He was a 10-term congressman from California. He was a Holocaust survivor. I knew him a little personally, and he was a very irritable guy, a cranky guy, a very aggressive advocate for Israel, and a very combative fellow. He was difficult to interview because he would take offense at almost anything and just go after you. What was he up to? Because he was clearly, I mean, it was no secret to anybody that he was one of the staunchest supporters of Israel in any level of our government.
Yeah, it was my understanding, both through briefing, but through the information that I gathered directly, based on communication taking place between several, you know, one target to one person, etc., that I heard. With Lantos, it was very interesting because it was not even the money issue with Lantos. He was not really getting much money for it. It was, he never considered himself a U.S. citizen. Lantos first considered himself an Israeli citizen.
Mm.
And he actually worked for the government of Israel because he was actively providing them with information, documents, highly classified documents. And then those Israeli agents operatives, when some information of the documents they obtained, if they were valuable to their you know, a little brother, the Turkish ATC and ATAA and other related organizations, then they would come and give it to them. They would share. You know, I would share this with my little brother coming through Lantos' office. And it came through Lantos' office, and it was obtained mainly not even through Lantos, even though that permission was given. He considered himself an Israeli. He did not consider himself an American. That was like his understanding of the target that we were monitoring. It was done through this person who actually worked for his office, who did a lot of other espionage-related activity, and his name is Alan Makovsky, and he still is in Congress. He has very high-level position.
Mm-hmm. And what about Dennis Hastert? He was a Republican congressman from Illinois who came out of obscurity to catapult into the Speaker's role in the House when Bob Livingston, who is now a lobbyist for Turkey through his company, the Livingston Group, He succeeded Newt Gingrich, but was only there for about 2 weeks and resigned because of an emerging sex scandal in his own past. So what was Hastert up to? And use this as an opportunity to tell us why Chicago is a hub for Turkish activity in the United States.
Right. Bob Livingston was their boy, the operative, target operative's boy there, Roy Blunt. And what happened was after he had to resign, and a lot of that didn't have to do with his sex scandals. He already knew that they were after him because if you look at the documents I have in my or on my organization's website, talks about certain representatives, U.S. representatives, who were directly tapped illegally.
Mm-hmm.
And he would be one of them, along with Dan Burton.
Burton of Indiana, uh-huh.
Correct. Mm-hmm. And so after he left, just like the same Solars, the Stephen Solars model, so he leaves, and not even a year, within less than like 6-7 months, he establishes Livingston Group, and he starts getting about $1.5 million from Turkey. And he had his boys in there, and one of them was Dennis Hastert. And Hastert's importance was, of course, he became the Speaker of the House, but the biggest importance for Hastert was because of where he came from, and that was Chicago, and where he had a lot of influence, because there was he had a lot of influence with the Illinois state legislators, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And he had a lot of dealings and connections and relationships with people within the local Chicago government. And Chicago was extremely important for these operatives, and it had been since 1988, 89.
Okay.
So that was Dennis Hastert's importance, and Mr. Hastert was very interested in money. I mean, I said, like, Tom Lantis is a different story. It was not material, and I don't even know if he knew a lot of the stuff that he got actually went to Turkish operatives, because he was not giving it to them. He was mm-hmm. giving it to the Israeli agents.
Uh-huh. Well, also, Lantos came from a very safe district, so he didn't need a lot of campaign money. I didn't know him that well, but he didn't appear to be terribly acquisitive himself. So
that's another thing. It was very hard because, well, we'll get into that when we get further. But I was political, but I was not political in terms of the U.S. Congress and the Senate and the House. And some of these names, I mean, I had to be briefed that, oh, this person is this, and this is position in this particular committee, because initially when I would listen to certain communication, it wouldn't even, you know, like, okay, so somebody in Congress, okay, the representative, and, well, then I would find out through briefing, okay, well, this person is also in this committee, and this committee has access to this and this, or that other person is in this committee, this representative, and currently there is this pressure to investigate this case, and this person can make it go away. Those things started making sense after I would hear this stuff, and both through my own research, but also through briefing from the agents that then I start getting. It's like, oh, I get it.
Mm-hmm. Now, this was not limited to Republicans. Jan Schakowsky, who is a Democratic congresswoman from Evanston on the North Shore of Chicago, also surfaced in an unusual way. Tell us about that.
That again had to do with Chicago operations, and again her name ended up surfacing a lot. In fact, creating its own file, not as thick of a file as the others, because she, again, I'm saying this based on my own conclusion, based on the other cases I saw. I assume because she was not interested in money, and that's my assumption, because I never heard directors saying she's not interested in money, okay? So this is, like, from me. The target operatives were trying to, what they called, hook her with getting information and obtaining things that they could go back and blackmail her. This is why I'm saying my personal conclusion is obviously she was not vulnerable to the dollars.
Mm.
Otherwise, they most likely would have given dollar. See, that part, I would say, is my own thing,
mm-hmm.
My own conclusion, assumption, but the fact that the hooking process was discussed in detail, and it was known to these operatives, these agents, the targets, that, and supposedly it was well known that she had preference for women when it came to sexual relationship,
mm-hmm.
and she always had that. In fact, they even knew her previous lover, whoever that person was. I don't know who that person was.
Mm-hmm.
And there were a lot of plannings in terms of who would be the best person who had already known her briefly, not closely, that would be the right person to hook Jan Schakowsky.
Mm-hmm.
So the information that I got privy to, I ended up listening to, had to do mainly with this hooking process of Jan Schakowsky. And I was terminated in 2002. I was fired in March 2002. And I never got to any point. I never went beyond that mid to end of 2001 to know what they did with that information, because they went through with the conversation would be, okay, for the mother's funeral, make sure she goes, because this would lead to this, and then we can have this particular place bugged at a certain time. So these were the discussions, and also discussions about, you know, her family, and the discussions about, but all the discussions that related to Ms. Schakowsky, Representative Schakowsky, they all had to do with Chicago and Illinois.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of the people they would name a person, a representative from the state legislature, again, maybe by first name, because Joe and, let's say, I'm not going to name all of them, 3, 4, they're all, you know, on board with this. We need to have her, or in certain cases, we need to have her district's thing. And a lot of that had to do with money laundering. A lot of that had to do with the financial money laundering operations they had set up, and they had set up. I'm saying they had, because I assume they have, but I'm going to say they had until 2002, and this was since 1988. The center of all those operations happened to be in Chicago.
Now, it's very interesting because you've been extremely careful with these allegations about Congresswoman Schakowsky, and you had a question mark up on your rogues gallery. You did not name her. You did not depict her. And the information surfaced from someone else. You were not the first to disclose this. Nonetheless, she has responded in a rather vitriolic way. And let me read a statement from her spokesperson regarding the information that you've offered. Quote, "As with all fairy tales, Ms. Edmonds' fantasy about Congresswoman Schakowsky was easily dismantled by introducing irrefutable facts. It is clear from reading her response that Ms. Edmonds has decided to change her story rather than admitting her charade had been revealed. It's unfortunate. Aside from the point that Congresswoman Schakowsky is married, not a single aspect of Ms. Edmonds' original story was true. The claims about Congresswoman Schakowsky do not have a leg to stand on and have been shown to be the stuff of science fiction and absurd conspiracy theory, absent of any factual basis, period." Now, that's a very strong denunciation that does not address the issues in any way, shape, or form. And you have responded with, I think, a very interesting and measured letter that people can read on your website at 123realchange.blogspot.com. And basically, you outline what you have been through, that you have possessed important information that the American people and that our elected officials deserve to know about, that you have spent a lot of your own money on legal fees and prosecuting a Freedom of Information Act case. You've been subjected to these gag orders that have cost you a great deal of money, and we're going to have to get into those issues in a future interview. But I really am touched by the letter that you wrote, and basically you, in a polite way, challenged the Congresswoman, who is a member of the Intelligence Committee, to set up some hearings to review this information and to bring out the truth. And I think that your response is excellent, especially considering the kind of nasty way that they have attacked you personally and not responded to the specific allegations that have been raised.
Uh-huh. Yeah, you explained it very well, and it's so very unfortunate because I have never alleged any wrongdoing on her part. Now, there may be some subjective or moral questions on people's mind about, okay, so she was married, then she was having this relationship. Again, that has nothing to do with her, at least I don't believe it has anything to do with her integrity, having an affair or not having an affair with her job, or the fact that she is either bisexual or she's gay. And again, from the district, based on where she comes from, and being very liberal, you know, this is not something to be ashamed of. And maybe it's a good thing to come out and just say, okay, this is who I am. But I was very disappointed because I have supported a lot of her actions in Congress. I mean, she has been outspoken on issues that many have not been. Or while many have just remained silent, especially her track record in with the recent case of this Blackwater, just I'd be cheering for that case, both the author of Blackwater book, Jeremy Scahill, but also for her to be the person behind this and pushing it. So the last thing I would want to do is bring upon some false information or accusation or smearing against somebody that I have to respect, okay? And if you want to make up, think about it this way. If I wanted to make up someone, why wouldn't I make up someone that most people hate? I mean, seriously, Peter, I've been getting emails from people saying, why couldn't you say Karl Rove was someone? Because I never came across the name Karl Rove, okay? Mm-hmm. I am not here to say who I don't like. How about Cheney? I'm so disappointed with you. You didn't name Cheney. Well, I did not hear Cheney.
Mm-hmm.
And I did not hear discussions that actually included Cheney. It went just as far as high as Wolfowitz. That was it. And then it's like, oh, man, why couldn't it be Pelosi or Harmon? I mean, think about it. Why would I pick someone that, A, I respect, B, is very popular person with progressives who I support?
Mm-hmm.
It would be crazy. I would be crazy to do that. So anyway, I was disappointed. But thinking about it, Peter, it's very important for this information, for this the whole case to come out publicly. Because let's say she was not blackmailed. Let's say they sat on that information. Let's say she never did any favor, okay?
Mm-hmm.
The fact that this information sits there and certain foreign agents have that information, And Representative Schakowsky, she is sitting on Intelligence Committee.
Right.
That's important, the fact that foreign agents have vulnerabilities. More important than that, the fact that the FBI files, DOJ files, contains this information on Schakowsky. And I tell you what, I have more concern on how our executive branch may use this information to blackmail or pressure our representative, people's representative, than even the foreign agents. And this may not make sense to a lot of people, but with what has been happening to our civil liberties, I do have this concern more than the foreign agents, even though foreign agent factor is absolutely important. So, another important aspect is she is the appropriate committee. She has the power. She has the authority. She, tomorrow morning, she can come out, have a press conference, and she say, okay, I am calling for an investigation and a hearing into this case. I'm going to summon all these agents, the ones who've been out of the FBI, the ones who are still in the FBI, to come, take the oath, and under oath testify about these issues. I will have Sabelle Edmonds come and testify. I will summon, subpoena all those documents and all those files from 1996 till 2002 that she's referring to. I want all the previous records from the Senate Judiciary Committee's investigation. And she can do this and bring out the truth. Let the truth be known. There is nothing in this truth that would hurt the national security if it comes out. Most of this deals with corrupt U.S., corrupt and greedy U.S. officials, traitors, people who commit treason. These are criminal matters. This has nothing to do with national security of the United States. They are the ones, by not being punished, by not being held accountable, that is what is causing our downfall. That's damaging us. That is damaging our national interest, our people's interest.
Well, I think you put it very well, Sabelle, and I think that you have just identified your motivation here. And I think it's very important for people to understand that you take no pleasure in describing what apparently occurred to Jan Schakowsky. And I think you are correct that if indeed, and I have no reason to doubt you, but I put it in conditional because I haven't seen any of this firsthand, but if indeed Jan Schakowsky was hooked by Turkish intelligence, then the only way to inoculate her from any vulnerabilities that linger, and as you pointed out, those vulnerabilities don't just apply to Turkish interests. It can be used in many different ways, including by political opponents here in our country. And the only way for her to get past that is for full disclosure. And that is the path forward here. And I also think it's important to point out that while the state secret privilege was used to impose this gag order on you, that it's pretty clear to me that this was designed to prevent embarrassment, and that if the operations and the illegal activities that you describe were fully disclosed, at this point, I can't see how it would affect our national security. It would certainly affect our relationship with Turkey and perhaps with Pakistan and Israel. But we really should confront those issues.
And purge our Congress of these parasites. That is the biggest accomplishment that we would get, or people within the State Department, and address this issue of lobby, address these huge loopholes in FARA, the Foreign Agents Registration Act. It has so many loopholes that we will hear more about during this Krikorian trial, that it doesn't even function. And so much good can come out of this as a result of this.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely. And again... luckily, she comes, you know, she has a constituency that would support her no matter what, and she has followers who would support her if she were to come and have full disclosures. They would not abandon her. They would not punish her for it.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
They would support her, and she has even that position. That's why I was very, I was surprised. I was disappointed. I mean, initially, I was even angry, saying, oh, my God, the only time I've had a public figure attacking my credibility was with Dennis Hastert. And Jan Schakowsky shouldn't be even compared to Dennis Hastert.
I agree.
So it came as a shock.
Yeah.
And so maybe that was her initial reaction. I hope she will read this letter. I'm going to send it to her office. And I hope she will think about it. I hope she will come forward. And I hope she will do what we've been waiting for the past 7-8 years.
Yeah.
She will have open public hearings. And now, don't forget this, Peter, please mark my word. The Senate Intelligence and House Intelligence Committees we're talking about, they are the ones that they usually have their hearings and their investigations, like, all classified and closed. And that's not something that I would ever participate in or support or endorse. The only hearing and investigations I would endorse would be the public one. Public hearing under oath, none of these classified inside the SCIF, secure facility, compartmentalized facility disclosures. Enough of that. I've done that for 8 years.
Yeah.
I have done that many times. Full public.
Well, Sabelle, we ambitiously launched into this an hour and a half ago, and it's clear to me that if you'll agree, we need to do another session because
most definitely
there's much more to talk about. We haven't really delved into the Ohio case between Congresswoman Jean Schmidt and her challenger, David Krikorian. That produced the opportunity for you to be deposed that triggered some of the recent coverage, and I want to delve into that. There are issues related to nuclear and military information that was traded to Turkey and other parties as well, and so I would like to pursue that in a future conversation.
Absolutely, and we'll do it anytime you ask me to.
Okay, well, we'll
have me as a guest.
We'll do it again. Honor. We'll do it again real soon, and try to get the second installment out within a week or two of the release of this conversation. And it's a daunting task, and you have much to say. And I really, you know, I wait for that day when we can have open public hearings under oath and get this on the record, so that the American people know what's been going on undercover. Sibel Edmonds, thank you for joining me today on the Peter B. Collins Show. I'd like your comments. Email me, peter@peterbcollins.com. And thanks for listening.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling.